My Classic Album with Mike Norris is part of Podnose, the UK's leading independent entertainment podcasting network. For episode archives of My Classic Album and all of the shows on the network, visit us at www.podnose.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at Podnose or send us an email via admin@podnose.com.
To another episode of My Classic Album, the show where we look back on some of the greatest albums in music history. I, of course, am Mike Norris. Welcome. Thank you very much for joining us, be it your first time, be it your 27th time. Are we on episode 27 now? I think we are. 27 episodes. It seems since we came back in February, we did 20 episodes from around 2016 into 2018, and then we came back in February with a second series of My Classic Album, and it seems like since we've done that, that there's a lot of momentum behind the podcast. People are getting really excited about it. A lot more people are listening. Some of the guests I'm getting are absolutely fantastic. But perhaps most importantly, the level of albums that we're covering. And I think you could say that for the whole time we've been doing the podcast. But I just feel like at the minute, the albums that we're covering are fantastic, truly classic albums. You know, within the past couple of months alone, we've done Appetite for Destruction, Born to Run. And then today, yet another phenomenally classic album. We will be looking at Aretha Franklin's I Never Loved a Man the Way That I Love You. It's always nice to veer off a little bit from the kind of albums that we usually do. I mean, I've got quite a varied musical taste, but as I'm sure regular listeners to the podcast will know, I'm very much into my classic rock, my heavy metal, and that forms the basis of the music that I love. But I like all sorts of stuff, and it's great when I get to explore other genres of music that I appreciate on the podcast. One of my favourite episodes that we did a couple of years ago now, we did an episode dedicated to Stevie Wonder's album, Fulfilling This's First Finale, which is a really underrated album by Stevie, and I thoroughly recommend you go and check it out if you're into Stevie Wonder and you're into that album. And my guest, Mark Danzeisen, and I, who was the drummer with the band River Dogs, broke that album down, and it is one of my favourite episodes still now to this day, but I really enjoyed my chat that I had with Nell Bryden that you're going to be hearing today. Nell is a phenomenal singer-songwriter. As I said in our previous episode, I was very excited for her to join us to chat about her classic album. And when she picked Aretha Franklin, I was really excited because for me, that's kind of what the podcast is about. For me personally, what I get out of it. It's great to do these episodes dedicated to Rumours and Battle of Hell and Appetite for Destruction, these albums that I love and play to death. But there's something about when someone picks an album that I haven't listened to before, or is by an artist where I think, actually, I've always wanted to kind of delve in and listen to more of their stuff. And, you know, the hits are there, but there's some really awesome tracks on this album. And it's ironic. I mean, I'm a massive Queen fan. Aretha Franklin was one of Freddie Mercury's idols. He absolutely loved her voice. So there's always been a part of me that's wanted to listen to Aretha Franklin and to get a bit more into her discography. Perfect opportunity. So thanks to Nell for choosing the album. And you will hear my chat with Nell about Aretha Franklin's I Never Loved a Man the Way That I Love You in just a little bit. And, you know, the story of this album is pretty crazy. And I think that's what I love when not only the music is awesome, but there's this absolutely unbelievable story behind it. So you'll hear all about that in just a little bit. So in a couple of weeks' time on My Classic Album, for the first time, we're going to be doing a movie soundtrack. Now, this isn't necessarily something that I thought that we would do in the early days of My Classic Album, but it totally fits the bill. And it's funny because, yes, it's a movie soundtrack, but the soundtrack and indeed the film itself had a huge influence on some of the music scenes that were going on at the time of the film's release. So that movie is the Rocky Horror Picture Show, and that's the soundtrack that we're going to be looking at in a couple of weeks' time with my guest Savannah Pope. And it's interesting because it's one of those films and it's one of those soundtracks where I don't know anyone who's like, yeah, it's all right. Either people love it or they just do not get it at all. And they're like, no, it's not for me. I love it. I talk a little bit in a couple of weeks' time about the first time that I saw the movie and my reaction to it. And the soundtrack, it's funny because it does have a very important role to play in the development of important musical genres of the 1970s in both music and in terms of fashion as well. So I won't say much more because obviously that's another episode for a couple of weeks' time. But it is a really good one. And it's interesting because, as I said, I didn't necessarily think we'd do a soundtrack, but Savannah suggested it. And it seems to me that if we're going to tackle a soundtrack, it should be one that's had a really profound effect on music. And this one totally has. So, yeah, in a couple of weeks' time, that will be the Rocky Horror Picture Show. Inevitably, we'll be touching on the film as well as the soundtrack, because obviously they go hand in hand. That'll be me and Savannah Pope on My Classic Album from the 15th of May. If you want to keep up to date with all that and future episodes and future classic albums and future guests, keep yourself on our social media pages. So if you look for My Classic Album with Mike Norris on our Facebook page, My Classic Album with Mike Norris, and like the page. You can follow us on Instagram at My Classic Album Podcast, and indeed you can follow us on Twitter as well for the amount of time that I'm there, which isn't much, at MCA_podcast. Although having said that, I was chatting to someone who was, I'm hoping, will be appearing on the show in a future episode, and she reached out through Twitter, so maybe I shouldn't delete it just yet, because I keep thinking I'm going to delete it. But, you know, I think I just need to get better at Twitter, is basically the thing. If you've got me on the Facebook page and Instagram, you'll know that I use them a lot, whereas Twitter just, it's like gathering dust in the corner somewhere. It's always been an app, a social media channel that I've struggled with, but I must get better. But I have been saying that for months, so, you know. But of course, all that information and information about the podcast, everything My Classic Album related, is on our official website at www.myclassicalbum.co.uk, the recently revamped myclassicalbum.co.uk, actually. I recently decided that I wasn't very happy with the website I had and had to play around with it, and I'm much happier with it now, and it seems that you guys are too, because when I do the boring kind of looking to see who's been visiting and this, that, and the other, there are a lot more people visiting the new My Classic Album page than the old one, which is exciting to see. I think a big part of that might be that you can actually listen to the podcast on the page. So previously you went on the My Classic Album page, it was a right faff to find the right episode that you wanted, and then when you clicked it took you to another page, whereas you can actually listen to any episode of the podcast on the website. So if you don't have a podcast app or you're not signed up to anything like that, it's the easiest way to do it is just to go to myclassicalbum.co.uk, click episodes, and then it just gives you a drop-down list of all our episodes so far, and press play. It's as easy as that. So my special guest today is Nell Bryden, and she has chosen Aretha Franklin's breakthrough album, I Never Loved a Man the Way That I Love You. But before we get to Nell and our conversation about the album, here are the facts. Here's the beginning of what you need to know about I Never Loved a Man the Way I Love You. I Never Loved a Man the Way I Love You is the 10th studio album from American soul singer Aretha Franklin. The album was the first for Aretha on Atlantic Records after she was signed to the label by Jerry Wexler. Jerry also signed on to produce the album, and work began at the iconic Fame Studios in Muscle Shoals, Alabama. After a disastrous first day involving a fight between Aretha's husband Ted White and studio owner Rick Hall, the album sessions nearly ended there and then. Fortunately, Jerry managed to persuade Aretha to resume the project at Atlantic Recording Studios in New York, and the album was released on March 10, 1967. The title track was released as the lead single off the album and proved to be the first major hit of Aretha Franklin's career. The single reached number 9 on the Billboard Hot 100 while reaching the top of the R&B singles chart. However, it was Respect, an Otis Redding cover which opens the album, that shot Aretha into the stratosphere, reaching the top of the Billboard Hot 100. And charting across the world, including number 10 in the UK. Off the back of two huge singles, I Never Loved a Man the Way I Love You proved to be Aretha's breakthrough, charting at number 2 in both the US and Canada, as well as reaching number 35 in the UK, her first album to hit the UK album chart. Sales of the album were strong enough to certify I Never Loved a Man gold in the United States. The album's importance in Aretha's career has led many to rank it amongst the greatest albums of all time. Q magazine placed it in its 100 greatest albums ever, while Pitchfork ranked it 10th in their best albums of the 1960s in 2017. And of course, Rolling Stone placed I Never Loved a Man the Way I Love You number 83 on its 500 greatest albums of all time list in 2012. So that's just the beginning of what we need to know about I Never Loved a Man the Way That I Love You. And I have here with me my special guest who chose the album to talk about today. This is Nell Brighton. How's it going?
Hi, Mike. How are you?
I'm great, thanks. Thanks very much. Before we get into it too much, why have you chosen I Never Loved a Man the way that I love you to talk about on my classic album here today?
Yeah, you asked me to be part of the show, and this was, of course, the first thing that popped into my head. And it's an album that I feel like, you know, like a wonderful love affair. It starts out a certain way, and I had a relationship to it when I first heard it that made me feel a certain way. And then as I became more experienced as a musician, I came to love it in different ways and understanding more and more about the context of it and the musicianship of it. It just became even more the depth of the feeling and the emotion that she delivers, and it just still hits me so hard. So I think it's an album that's an obvious choice because for me as a singer, it really has, you know, it made a tremendous difference in terms of, you know, the style that I want. And also I've used it as a production reference because I love the sound of it too.
So what are those initial memories of hearing that album for the first time?
Well, I remember I recorded my first album down in Nashville, and then I felt sort of disillusioned with the music business after that because it wasn't terribly well received. And I felt like I was trying to do something that was potentially just trying to please people and sound a bit more contemporary. And I hadn't really found my way yet stylistically. And I went down, I was living in New York City at the time, which I love New York. It's my hometown, but it's a sort of dog eat dog kind of music scene. And so I was too focused on the business side of things. So I took myself down to New Orleans for a little trip to fall in love with music again, get away from all of the sort of business side of things. And I was staying on Frenchman Street, and I was in this little wonderful Airbnb at the time. And I would go out and I would listen to music every day. And I found all these wonderful musicians. And even though this album, Aretha's album, was recorded in Muscle Shoals in Alabama, there is something to be said about New Orleans being part of that sort of Southern soul sound. So I remember standing in a driveway when I was down there recording this album of songs that I'd written down in this month that I'd been down there. And it was this like, I just remember so clearly looking at this cracked driveway, and there was sort of weeds popping through, and it was this old studio. Nothing worked. Everything was breaking. And we'd have all these session musicians that were incredible session musicians. But, you know, some of them would get so inebriated during the session that like the drummer would fall off his stool. You know what I mean? Like it was just total chaos in the way that only New Orleans can be. And I remember looking around and having to take a break from this complete cacophony of mess and noise and just kind of earthiness, and standing out in this driveway and putting on headphones and listening to Baby, Baby, Baby and Do Right Woman and Never Loved a Man, the whole album, but my special favorites from it, and feeling like when I was looking at this cracked driveway and this hot day, there was something earthy and rejuvenating about her sound and her voice. And it brought me back to a very essential emotional place. It made me feel grounded again. And I think that the album has had that effect on me throughout the years. I live in London now, and it just was the thing that I used as a reference on my latest recording. But it had that same feeling of looking down at the cracked pavement and having the weeds pop through and putting on the headphones and thinking, God, this is really just bringing me to the essential part of life that's important.
So I Never Loved a Man the Way That I Love You is actually the 10th studio album by Aretha Franklin, but it is her first with Atlantic Records. We'll get into why that's so significant shortly, but for those 9 previous studio albums that she recorded in the early 60s, she was actually signed to Columbia. Have you heard much of her work from her time at Columbia, and how does it differ?
Yeah, I haven't. It really didn't do that much for me. I think that she was sort of, you know, it's a bit sort of like what happened to Sam Cooke, too. She was just kind of trying to be a bit too jazzy. They didn't really know where she fit, and it felt like it was this tremendous talent. And she really, there was no denying the ability that she had, but it just didn't have that sort of, that moving, earthy quality that sort of grab you by the neck and, you know, throw you into the vulnerability of life. It just didn't do that. It didn't kind of, make me or I suppose people at the time stand up and take notice. So this was a complete departure. And it was Jerry Wexler at Atlantic that, you know, I think really spearheaded what we know now as Aretha and her sort of seminal sound.
And I think it's really interesting you should talk about your reaction to the album. It seems that that's the consensus, that maybe she wasn't reaching her full potential. And I've got a quote from Spooner Oldham, who plays piano on I Never Loved a Man.
Oh, Spooner, amazing. Yeah.
He told Uncut magazine about his first impressions of her. He said, "I hadn't heard much about her. I had an LP by her on Columbia, and I'd maybe listened to it once and put it aside. In my mind, it was cocktail bar background music. I ignored it, to be honest," which almost just seems laughable now, but it shows how much that this album that we're talking about turned things around for her.
Well, exactly. I mean, I think, first of all, Spooner's a genius, but it was like that. It just had this kind of like it was trying to make it palatable for the masses. It was not embracing her essential gospel, earthy quality. She wasn't playing on the early Columbia records too. And she's a wonderful pianist. And she just, you know, she's one of those players where she kind of needs to accompany herself to really bring it to her gospel soul roots. And it just felt like they were just trying to make it too polite or something. And that just is not her voice.
Now, so if we go back to 1967, so we've talked about she was somewhat plateauing, I guess, with Columbia. They drop her from the label and she's in a serious amount of debt. And it's Jerry Wexler, who you've touched on, who had that idea to bring her to Atlantic Records. And I've got a quote from Jerry as well. He told Rolling Stone in 1968, "I'd heard her sing on records and I just thought she was fabulous. And I thought it would be nice if I'd have the opportunity to record her someday. I had no intimation that she was going to have a string of number one million sellers and she would upset the world. The ballads and blues she sang at Columbia were a little manicured. We just went in and started doing our so-called style of recording her." So I guess there's something in everything we're hearing so far around Aretha perhaps being underestimated, maybe even that she took people by surprise with this album, not just the music buying public, but perhaps even Atlantic as well.
Yeah, it's lovely that Jerry said that the sound before was manicured, because it was, and it was trying to, and by manicured, it's like filed down and contained and polished and very trim. And that just misses the soaring quality of letting her really go free. And I think that Jerry brilliantly brought her down to Muscle Shoals, which is a tiny, tiny little town in Alabama. For people that don't know about it, it's absolutely, for how many records have come out of this little town? It's like, it's like the high street of some small little UK town. Like, it's tiny. And there were these wonderful the studio musicians there in the Fame Studios that were the regular studio band. They were all white musicians, actually. Nobody knows that, or very few people, I suppose, know that. But they were all white and they were all buddies and they just played together a lot. And they had this really earthy sound. Spooner, who's the organ player, you're talking about him before, and he would do these great organ swells. And Jared brought Aretha down there. And I think that was really the change, because I Never Loved a Man the Way I Love You was the first song and the only song that they did down there. But just that sound allowed her as a singer to have the grounding of the background and the sort of, I keep going back to the word earthy, but that is because that's the opposite of manicured, isn't it? It's not jazzy and polished. It's got this grit to it and this sense of like really almost primal emotional quality to it. And I think that made the difference. I know as a singer, if you don't have the right arrangement behind you and the right instrumentation, you don't get the feeling and you don't get that sort of quality in your voice that is like, I'm communicating something really important now. Listen.
No, exactly. And I mean, Jerry's vision, we've talked a lot there about Muscle Shoals. Jerry's vision was Aretha performing with those session musicians at the Fame Studios. And that was so Aretha could be backed by the in-house band that we've been talking about, the Muscle Shoals rhythm section. So founder of the studios, Rick Hall, jumped at the chance to work with Jerry. So it was win-win for both sides. The Muscle... try saying that three times.
It's a hard word. I know. Muscle Shoals.
The Muscle Shoals rhythm section have performed on more than 500 recordings for the likes of Etta James, Wilson Pickett, and Paul Simon. Now, you've started to touch on this already. How important is their contribution to this album for you? And do you think that they help Aretha raise the bar from what came before?
100%. Absolutely 100%. Because basically what happened was, well, I know, as I was saying, as a singer, if you have the right musicians backing you, people that feel familiar when you've just played with them for the first time, they have the right sound, the right really bass heavy, very sort of warm and inspiring sound, then a certain quality is going to come out in your voice. So they recorded this song, I Never Loved a Man the Way I Love You. And that for me on this entire album is the track that stands out as the sort of linchpin for the entire new sound, everything that's going on. Well, we can get into the sort of time period of when that's coming out and why that's so significant in terms of history later. But from a musical standpoint, it was clear that something immediately was different and that she, you know, there was a special quality in the room. But then wasn't there some sort of crazy, she was married to her manager at the time. I think his name was Ted White, was it?
That's
right.
His name
was Ted White. And she was married to him. He went down with her. And then I think there was like everybody was drinking at the session. And then one of the players sort of said something flirty to Aretha. And I think Ted didn't take very well to it. And so he had some big Barney with them. And he ended up pulling her and saying, "We're out of here." And so then they left. I think they did like one other song, but it hadn't really worked yet or something. And so he pulled her out and he said, we're not doing it anymore. Now, can you imagine that? You just like played the most incredible track and that's it. This is a whole new sound. Everybody knows it's on. And then all of a sudden the manager's like, yeah, we're out of here because the trumpet player flirted with my wife and I'm not having that. So he pulls them back to New York and then Jerry's like, whoa, 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 we have to figure this out. We got to get these guys, you know, playing this record. So he flies all of the Muscle Shoals Fame studio band up to New York and a lot of them then continue on and play the rest of the record. But that, so of course the musicians that came from that Alabama earthy sound then were flown up to New York. And so it was a whole different ballgame then. So the rest of the record could have been made. But without that initial, we're going to come to your little backwater town and get your, you know, amazing sound. None of this would have happened. So I do think the musicians made a tremendous difference.
And it's really interesting you should talk about this kind of incident that happened, because it is, it's hugely fascinating and there's been so much written about it. So as you'd said, I Never Loved a Man the Way I Love You was recorded. Everyone was really, really happy with it. And it was Ted White, Aretha's husband, who was present and was unhappy at the fact that he thought the trumpeter Ken Laxton had made a pass at Aretha. So whipped her out of there, as you say. And then from what I can gather, Rick Hall attempted to smooth things over with Ted, went to the hotel to speak with them and end up getting in a fist fight.
It sounds like Ted's a real jerk, doesn't it?
So at this point, you know, this album at this point is dead in the water when there's just been this absolutely phenomenal recording. You say this really important song to the album. And at this point, and obviously we can talk a little more about, you know, obviously they got to New York and things got back on track. But at that point, Jerry Wexler was probably thinking, oh my God, like, what's happening to this album?
We've got this magic and now it's done. Yeah. What are we going to do?
Exactly. And I mean, from what I can gather, we can touch on this a little bit more when we go track by track. But, you know, obviously they finished the album in New York and everything was great. What I think is interesting is that we recently covered Born to Run by Bruce Springsteen on the podcast.
Oh, wow.
Now, these two albums have quite a similarity, which is very coincidental that we do them so close to each other. So obviously the title tracks were given an early release to radio stations before the album was even finished. So I Never Loved the Man the Way That I Love You was released to radio stations. And I've got a quote here from a website called Every Record Tells a Story that talks about what happened next. So it says, Jerry Wexler had no album. All he had was 1.5 recordings and his artist was refusing to come back to record any more songs. So Wexler acted decisively. He printed 20 or 30 acetates of the finished song and sent them to key DJs who immediately played the song on the airwaves. Radio listeners loved the new Aretha sound. Distributors cried out for copies of the song to sell. Wexler stalled. The good news was that on their first attempt, Wexler and Aretha Franklin at last had a hit. The bad news was it was only a hit on radio. So, in a very similar scenario to Born to Run, we have this song that's gaining huge traction on the radio, but there's no album. And in this case, there might not even be an album to capitalize on this momentum.
Right.
Which is just insane. However, due to the success of I Never Loved a Man the Way That I Loved You, Aretha agreed to resume recording, as you'd said, with the Muscle Shoals Band, and the project started up again in New York. So those sessions brought forth some of the finest songs of her career, including Do Right Woman, Do Right Man, and of course, Respect. So we'll go into these more in a minute, because we're about to go track by track. Do you feel that you can hear a sense of confidence on these other tracks? This idea that we already know that the new Aretha Franklin has been embraced and everyone's really excited to hear what she's got to do and that Jerry Wexler's vision has come together as he'd hoped.
You know, I do. And this is where I want to touch on the sort of historical significance of when this album came out in 1967. In America in 1967, there was a lot of, well, in the early 60s, there was Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement, and people like Sam Cooke were writing A Change Is Going to Come in 1964, which is the last track on this album. She covers it. But more than just sort of the civil rights movement and being Black in America and having, you know, this incredible injustice, but needing to sort of claim your individuality and your, you know, your expression and your ability to really be something significant in the world, and be taken seriously. I think there's a much bigger component to this particular album in that there is a real female empowerment to it. And I think what's interesting is knowing the backstory of, for instance, Aretha being down in Muscle Shoals, surrounded by all these guys. She's the only woman there except for her sisters who, did they go down? I'm not sure they went down originally, but do you know if they went down, her backup singers, when it was Carolyn?
I know they're in New York. I'm not sure if they were.
They're definitely in New York, but I'm not sure that they went to Muscle Shoals. So picture this young girl. Now, backstory on Aretha too. She comes from a very gospel family. Her father was a preacher. She was around music. Her mother died when she was 12. She was raised by sort of very influential women in her life. One of them was Mahalia Jackson. So she's got a lot of powerful women in her life, but she's also pregnant with two kids by the age of 16, And she leaves them in Detroit and she goes to New York to try to go make it. And you said, you know, at the end of her Columbia run, she's massively in debt. Well, personally, she's also left her babies in Detroit to go make it. And, you know, I have a child, you have a child. We both know it would be really hard, if not impossible, to leave your children behind. You'd have to have such an unfailing belief in your ability as a singer and your need to get out there in the world to be able to sacrifice being around your family. So she's done all of this. Then she's married to this guy, Ted White. She goes down to Muscle Shoals. She's recording this first song down there. And he, you know, because some guy talks to her in the band, it didn't sound like it was all that offensive at the time, but, you know, her husband took it like offensive. And then he has this power to say, well, we're out of here. And she just has to kind of go along with it. The reason I bring this up is that because I think there's this very interesting duality running through the entire album, reflected musically in the circumstances of this female empowerment. She is right on the brink of claiming her self-determination as a woman. She's really showing self-confidence and a knowledge of herself in a way that she hadn't been able to before, and that women were just breaking through at that point. But I mean, as a Black woman, it'd be incredibly hard. But at the same time, she's still really quite controlled by various men in her life. And it takes the good ones like Jerry Wexler to give her the opportunity to be herself. But she's quite vulnerable. And I think what I'm trying to say musically is that there's that sense of vulnerability running through the album, but somehow that vulnerability is her power. It's just bizarre how it just, you know, that's happened with other singers as well that I absolutely adore, like Janis Joplin or Patsy Cline or Maria Callas, you know, completely disparate styles of music, but they all have this duality of total vulnerability and then total toughness, take no prisoners. I am on fire. I am a powerhouse. And I love that duality. I think that makes for such interesting music, such emotionally powerful music. So yeah, I think that's the aspect that I'm getting at. Not just that she was, you know, recording this whole thing and doing this whole album, we can get into the track by track, but that as a woman, she was just on this edge of going to explore her self-determination and still being held back by these various controlling men in her life.
I know you'd said there that Jerry is one of the good men in her life that was trying to kind of help her kind of get to where she needed to be. And I mean, obviously at this point, he was already a pretty prominent producer. He'd worked with Ray Charles.
Yeah.
A lot is said about his sense of timing being a huge strength. And you talked about kind of where Aretha was in her life and where America was at that point in the 60s. Is there something to be said for kind of Jerry's timing here, and that the album is a combination of the right artist and the right musicians and the right producer in the right time, just kind of everything coming together, kind of the perfect storm almost?
Yeah, you know, I think that there's been a couple of seminal people. Jerry was a wonderful producer, but he was sort of finding talent. Sort of like a John Hammond is the same way, where he just kind of, both these men had the incredible ability to find talent and know that the zeitgeist was at the right point to receive that talent. And I think that Jerry had that unique gift to really see that, you know, Aretha was a talent that had not reached her potential yet because she needed this earthy, self-determined, empowered sound, but that the world was ready for that too. 1967 was an incredible shift in American politics, and people were getting into Vietnam, and it was really, I mean, we were already in Vietnam, but it was escalating. And then by 1968, Martin Luther King was assassinated, and there was, and then Bobby Kennedy was assassinated. I mean, it was a terrifying time in America, to be honest. People sort of romanticize the baby boomers and being hippies and all this music that was coming out. But I think a lot of the reason why all this flourishing of the arts was because it was actually a very unsettled time that was quite scary for people, and they just didn't know. I mean, you know, just from what I hear from my dad and people back then, people did not know what was going to happen in the world at all, and with a total lack of knowing what was going to happen, and then this great big new generation of baby boomers coming up thinking we can change things and we can really do something different. And then the civil rights movement having at the same time, it's just all of these factors really made America and the world ready to step over the threshold to a new, you know, style and existence and understanding.
And now seems the perfect time to go track by track. And
okay.
We'll start with our opening track, which is Respect, perhaps the signature song from Aretha Franklin. Many people may be surprised to learn that this is actually a reworking of a song by Otis Redding. And the reason that I've called it a reworking rather than a cover version, we'll get into. But before we get into that, have you listened to the Otis Redding version? And for those who haven't, how does it differ to what Aretha recorded on this album?
Well, she really, you know, I'm a huge Otis Redding fan. That was not really one of my favorite ones of his, you know, and I think that she's changed the pronouns. She's sort of done some riffing where she sort of says R-E-S-P-C-T, take out the T-C-P, so she becomes Reese, which was her nickname. And she's really kind of claiming this song for her own. And there's something about her, as you said, reworking of it, that with all the sort of Sakatumi background singers and just this kind of power that just makes it like it's suddenly a female empowerment song. Whereas when he was singing, it was just a totally different song. I mean, what's your impression of when he's singing it?
Well, it's funny you should ask that. It's almost, obviously, it's coming from a male perspective. And it's like a man who's kind of, he's asking for respect from his wife when he comes home. It's almost kind of got a pleading vibe to it.
Right, I know. There's something
Please
kind of,
respect me.
I love Otis, but there's a bit of a loser quality to it, you know?
Yeah.
And I adore him so much. I should say this. He's like another artist that has just completely inspired me throughout my life. But that is not one of my favorite songs of his. And I think that, you know, she had every right in 1967 to say, I'm a black woman, you need to respect me, you need to show me some respect here. And the way that she does it too, so it's as you were saying, he's pleading, but there's a joy in the way that she does it. There's this kind of like fanciful freedom that she is, that you, a quality in her voice, that it's like she's a bird just let out of a cage. And it's just kind of infectious, you know, and she just, it's a whole different emotional quality that she delivers in her version of it.
Yeah, and I almost feel like, you know, we're talking about Otis, his version having kind of a pleading vibe to it. I almost feel that Aretha's, she isn't so much asking for respect as demanding it at this point.
Yeah, she's demanding it. Exactly. Yeah.
Absolutely.
And it's radical.
Yeah. So from what we can gather, Aretha had actually been performing Respect live for several years by this point. Do you get the sense from the recording that this is a song that she's very comfortable with at this point, almost as if it were a road with the changes she's made?
Yeah, I do. I get that sense that she's just sort of, it's like one of those songs that the singer becomes so familiar with that it becomes their own. I think, you know, Aretha is like a lot of artists, you know, I think Bonnie Raitt is another one where they somehow manage to turn other people's songs into their version of it that is just, you know, that becomes the definitive version. Like Patsy Cline was Crazy. That was written by Willie Nelson, but it's Patsy Cline, that it's her song, you know? So Aretha sort of does that with this song. She's just played it so many times. She's so familiar with it. She really owns it in a way that has a sort of, yeah, like this is an ownership quality to her. It's really like, there's a you know what I mean. I need more coffee.
So what I really like about this is that Respect was actually recorded on Valentine's Day in 1967.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
oh,
and
wow.
I like that. And it was Aretha and her sister Carolyn who were singing back and vocals on the song, and they came up with that Sock It To Me section and the spelling out of R-E-S-P-E-C-T, which for me are the most memorable moments in the song.
They
which
are.
They obviously aren't. They're not present in Otis's version. In his 2014 book, Respect, The Life of Aretha Franklin, David Ritz says the song took on a universality the original never had. It's a credit to her genius she was able to do so much with it. She should have been listed as a co-producer on the song. Do you agree with David that Aretha and perhaps even Carolyn should have production credits on this song?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, I think so. I think in this modern day, they certainly would have. But I think, you know, at the time, that would have been sort of unheard of. So it's understandable that they don't. But I think that, you know, they certainly they should have arrangement credits. And it's hard to know whether it's production credits or writing credits. I mean, these are sort of nebulous things when you get into the studio and you sort of change something and make it your own. There's a lot of different ways that things can become your own. It's the musicianship, the arrangement. So like, you know, we're going to have the people come in here and sing this, and we're going to have these instruments underneath us. And then the production of like, well, I want it to sound like at this section, we're going to do it like this. And then we're going to have these people singing this bit, and I'm going to sing this lead part. And so, yeah, I think she could have gotten production qualities, but you know, that's also just part of being a determined artist, a self-determined artist, you know? And so I understand why she didn't get them.
So due to the strong, empowering message of Aretha's interpretation of the song, Respect, as we've been talking about, it quickly became an anthem for the women's and the civil rights movements happening in America at the time. And even now, I'd say, is regarded by many as a feminist anthem. But I guess the fact that she made the song her own in such a huge way is quite the feminist statement in itself, that she's taken this song that she must have enjoyed the original, she must have liked it, but she's made it her own, completely made it her own, in a way that I don't think any other cover version I can think of has done that.
No, exactly. Yeah. That she has made it her own. And when people think of Aretha Franklin, they think of that song. And when they think of that song, they think of Aretha Franklin. So, you know, they're sort of symbiotic, one and the same. And so I think that's the pure definition of making a song your own.
So the song, of course, as we've said, is one of the most recognisable and iconic songs of all time. In 2002, the Library of Congress added Respect to the National Recording Registry, while Rolling Stone named it fifth on its 500 Greatest Songs of All Time list. Before we move on, what is it that's so special about this song that has made it such a huge part of music and culture 50 years on, over 50 years on from when it was recorded?
I think it still sounds fresh. I think that's one of those things that a classic song still sounds immediate. There's something about the way that she just sort of sounds on the mic. Now, we obviously have much better recording techniques now, but there's something about the way that her vocals sound on that particular mic, and they're sort of distorting the mic because she's so loud. She has this real gospel sound that it just sounds hip still. And there's something, you know, that in conjunction with all of the sort of political background that we've talked about of female self-empowerment and sort of demanding self-respect. And then that musical immediacy, it still sounds fresh.
So we'll move on to Drown in My Own Tears. Drown in My Own Tears was written by songwriter Henry Glover, and it's been recorded by many, many other artists before and after Aretha Franklin, going back as far as 1951. So one of the most well-known versions was recorded by Ray Charles.
Yeah, and I love his version. So, I mean, this is one of those ones where I love her version and I love his version. So both, you know, it's not the same as Respect for me. I love her version. I absolutely adore it. But I love his version as well. So, you know, go figure.
So obviously you're saying obviously you enjoy both versions and there are many other versions out there. How do you think that Aretha makes this one her own? What is it that's unique about her version as opposed to Ray Charles or any of the other people who've recorded it?
Well, I think there's a quality in her voice that I was talking about again that is very feminine, and there's a vulnerability in her voice. I mean, Aretha has so much color in her palette as a singer. Well, there's a lot of singers like, you know, that have this sort of vocal fireworks, I call it, that they can do, like Mariah Carey, and they can have huge, tremendous range. But when they go to a low range or a more intimate sound, it just sort of all sounds like one tone. Whereas her tone, when she's being quite intimate, sounds really very vulnerable and very sexy and very sensual. And then she gets into this huge sort of soaring, like gospel stabs that she does way up high that clearly show off her power. And it's almost like this sort of, you know, unleashing of the inner psyche. But she just, I think that the way that she sort of tempers that on this song with this very vulnerable lower register, you know, very soft, raspy quality in her voice, I just adore it.
So when you have a song like this that's well known and there've been a lot of interpretations of it, is it difficult to make it unique to you? Is it easy to kind of fall into that trap of paying homage to what came before at the risk of kind of stifling your own creativity?
Yeah, and I think that this is then maybe an example where it's probably a combination of her feeling this energy of allowing herself finally to really be more gospel, which is where she came from, and sing it the way that she would want to sing it. And then also having these musicians from Muscle Shoals, from the Fame Studio, to be there backing her up, because it's just naturally going to make it its own thing. You're just naturally not going to play it like, you know, Ray Charles would have played it or other people would have played it. It's just going to be different. So, I mean, even though Ray Charles also came from gospel, it just, you know, he was a man. So it's inevitably going to be her own thing. And I think that was one thing about Aretha, was that she sort of has this fearless quality in her sound.
So I've got a quote from Clash Music talking about this track. I guess what's interesting about Drowning My Own Tears is that it was recorded on that same Valentine's Day in 1967 as Respect, and it follows Respect on the album, and that's a huge act to follow. I mean, Clash Music have said, no one can sing the blues like Aretha. Ray Charles' Drown in My Own Tears, previously recorded by Dinah Washington, tugged so hard at the heartstrings you could almost hear them snap.
Well, Dinah Washington. Can you imagine trying to follow in Dinah Washington and Ray Charles' footsteps? I mean, just be ridiculous, you know? She's incredible. Have you heard Dinah Washington, Red Sails in the Sunset? I mean, she's another just an amazing singer. Absolutely adore her. So, yeah, it would be challenging to follow in their footsteps. But I think Aretha had paid her dues at this point, so she knows that she's got, like I said, you got to take into her account her history. She'd left her babies behind. She'd gone to New York. She'd gotten tremendously into debt, and she's leveraged everything to be here. So she's not going to mess around. She's going to give this everything she has, and you can tell that she does.
So one similarity between this version and Ray Charles's is that both were produced by Jerry Wexler. So do you believe that's evident from both recordings of the song? Is that something you can tell? Is he the kind of producer that leaves a particular mark on a song or an album?
Yeah, actually, I think so, because I think that he was also, he was an enabler in a good sense. Like, he was somebody that allowed Aretha to be Aretha and was very, like I said, he was like a good male presence in her life. And she had so many negative ones that she probably felt really quite safe and understood by him, because both of these songs really seem to be her. Like, of course, I don't know her. I never met her, but I get this sense that this is really her in these two songs. And I think that that's a nice, that's one of the best production things that you can hear, is that the artist really sounds like themselves on them.
So that's my chat so far with Nell Bryden about Aretha Franklin's 1967 album, I Never Loved a Man the Way That I Love You. And we're going to get back to my chat with Nell very shortly indeed. I'd love to hear your thoughts on my chat with Nell about the album, any burning issues that you've got with our conversation so far. So check out our social media pages. Like I said earlier, get yourself on Facebook, Twitter and Instagram, and let me know what you think of this classic album. Coming up, who was King Curtis, the man who persuaded Aretha to resume the I Never Loved a Man sessions? And as a self-professed Sam Cooke fan, does Nell prefer his or Aretha's version of A Change Is Gonna Come? All that and more right after this.
Enjoying this episode of My Classic Album? Don't forget there are loads of amazing albums covered in our previous episodes as part of Season 1, with guests including Guns N' Roses keyboardist Dizzy Reed.
If I had to pick one like favorite band, or I guess a band that was the biggest influence on me, I would go with the Rolling Stones.
Blues guitarist Big Boy Blotter.
It sounded great then and it sounded great now. It just seems to have stood the test of time with me anyway. So yeah, it's a real classic for me.
And Nathan Stevens Griffin of Martha.
It's a great song musically, you're absolutely right. It's a banger. Mm-hmm. It is like absolutely a barnstormer of an album opener right there.
Also, there's our anniversary episodes, such as 40 Years of Rumours with Fleetwood Mac, including an interview with engineer Ken Kelly.
Within about 15 minutes, the band was fighting. I've seen, you know, Crosby, Stills and Nash fight. I've seen Kenny Loggins and Jim Messina fight, but this was a weird, I've never seen couples fight.
And 40 Years of Bat Out of Hell, including an interview with the voice of Paradise by the Dashboard Light, Ellen Foley.
Time is sometimes tricky. Sometimes things seem like very long ago in another life, which it is, but it all, the memories of it and certainly the song itself is always sort of alive in my mind.
All these episodes and more are available at www.myclassicalbum.co.uk and on Podnos, the UK's leading independent entertainment podcasting network.
So we'll move on to our title track, I Never Loved a Man the Way That I Love You. This is the one song that we said that was completed at Fame Studios before all the drama that unfolded. And I Never Loved a Man was a song that Aretha brought with her to the sessions, and it was written by songwriter Ronnie Shannon. Yeah, I'd say it is my favourite song on the album. Before we get any further, I know you've said, obviously, how you feel about the song, and you've said how important the song is to the whole vibe of the album. Would you like to kind of go into that a little more?
Well, it starts out with Spooner Oldham, who's the organ player down in Muscle Shoals. He's playing Wurlitzer, and it's this kind of dirty, whirly sound that is really just so, like, I keep coming back to this word earthy, but it's very earthy and bluesy and swampy. And it just kind of sets the tone. And I think from there that, you know, everything just sort of kicks in and it's just this really, I don't know, inspiring sound. But I still think that this is the seminal song for the entire album. It just sort of, it's the one for me that I always go back to. If I get one song from this album, I always go back to this one.
And it's interesting that you use the word bluesy there, because Aretha actually chose the song in response to Jerry Wexler wanting her to record a blues song.
Oh, really?
So while I wouldn't necessarily describe Aretha Franklin as a blues artist, I can totally understand how this song has elements associated with the blues. And I guess you'd agree with me from kind of the adjective that you that it could be seen by some as a blues number, or it could be reinterpreted into a blues number quite easily.
Yeah, and the way the horns come in, they all just sound sort of swampy blues. It really is just, and I love, again, this is another one where the quality of her lower register versus her upper register, and she just so effortlessly switches in between the two, and they both serve a purpose for what she's trying to get across emotionally, which is just like pleading or pillow talk or I'm gonna come and get you or you're mine or like I am totally beholden to you. I mean, she switches between these totally disparate emotions and somehow gets them all across in all these various colors of her voice. It's amazing.
So we've said how important this song is to the album. It was somewhat of a light bulb moment where everyone realized that something special was happening. But it seems like initially there was a bit of a struggle to get things started. So I've got a quote from Aretha herself from an interview she gave in 1999. She said, "It just wasn't quite coming off, although we had dynamite players. We had the Muscle Shoals section and they were really very, very hot. Cutting them out of good greasy stuff, or whatever you would call greasy in that day, but we weren't getting to the music in the way that we should have. It just wasn't coming off. Finally, someone said, 'Aretha, why don't you sit down and play?' And I did. And it just happened. It all happened. We arrived and we arrived very quickly. It's a good man who knows when he should get out of a woman's way."
Yeah, I know that quote. I love that. And I think that that, like I was mentioning earlier, that is one of the turning points on this album with Atlantic versus all of her Columbia records, was that she starts playing. And she's a wonderful pianist. And there's a confidence that comes when she is running the band, when she is leading the band. And, you know, and I think that that stylistically and rhythmically, it sort of determines a lot. So it makes perfect sense to me.
And I mean, obviously, we've talked about how important that decision was for her. And that moment, I guess, when someone said, "Well, why don't you play?" How important that was. Putting aside kind of the importance of it and putting aside her incredible voice, just as a piano player, just to kind of look at it from face value, how do you rate her as a piano player?
Brilliant. She's amazing. She's an incredible pianist. She could have been a superstar pianist without ever being a singer. She's so good. Like, really adept and lyrical and then incredible accompanist. She just really knows exactly where the stabs are supposed to be. I mean, she's fantastic. I really rate her.
So Rolling Stone named this song second on its 50 greatest Aretha Franklin songs ever last year. I bet you can guess what came first.
Right, exactly.
But they say of "I Never Loved a Man the Way That I Love You," it's one of her signature songs and a flair signalling that signing with Atlantic Records also represented a shift in how she was approaching her artistry. Would you agree with what's said here, that the song, and therefore the album, it's almost a document of how differently Aretha was dealing with her career at this time compared to her time at Columbia?
Yes, absolutely. Totally.
So we'll move on to Soul Serenade. So it's another song with a life beyond this album. Soul Serenade started life as a jazz song by King Curtis from his 1964 album of the same name. Aretha, by this point, already had a close friendship with King Curtis, and that likely played a part in her covering this song. What do we know about King Curtis in terms of the role that he played in Aretha Franklin's career and her life, I guess?
Well, I don't know. You'll have to tell me, actually.
Well, interestingly, he actually became Aretha's musical director. So he actually played a really important role in her career.
I mean, he plays the sax on this album, doesn't he?
He does, yeah. And I think what's the reason for that is really interesting. So if we go back to that incident where, obviously, Ted and Aretha left, they weren't coming back, there was a fist fight and everything was lost, it was actually King Curtis that Jerry Wexler went to and said, "Look, I need to get this back on track. You need to talk to Aretha. You need to get her back there." So he was actually the man who persuaded Aretha to return to those recording sessions. And one of those conditions was that King Curtis appeared on the album.
Oh, wow.
So there's a real interest in kind of, without him, we probably wouldn't be sitting here talking today.
Huh. Well, so then he was another of the good male presences in her life.
Exactly. That's definitely how I feel about it. Absolutely. And I guess that's testament to the friendship that they had and for lack, excuse the pun, the respect that Aretha had for King Curtis, that he could persuade her to return to a really potentially volatile situation that she wasn't happy with.
Yeah, she trusted him. And I think that if she had known him sort of musically and had worked with him in the past, then there is going to be a certain level of friendship. So, yeah.
So music website Drowned in Sound singles out Soul Serenade for very high praise. It says, "Without a doubt, the true magnetism of Soul Serenade lies in the inimitable voice of Aretha Franklin. The way she forcefully coos and wails comfortably in each pocket of the instrumental, slowly building to a stunning, reverberating crescendo with each subsequent cadence. Without a shred of hyperbole, it's truly one of the most groundbreaking recordings of the 20th century." Would you agree with that? Is it a groundbreaking recording?
Do you know, this is not one of my favorites on the album. I like it, but, you know, I wouldn't die for it. I would die for "I Never Loved a Man." It's just like one of those songs is just unbelievable. Or "Baby, Baby, Baby," or "Do Right Woman." We're going to get to those. But Soul Serenade is good. And I, you know, I never fast forward through it. But I wouldn't say for me, I can see that it's an incredible vocal performance. And it clearly, you know, in the title is also heralding in, you know, she's the queen of soul. And so this is her title that she is claiming now. But as a song, this is just testament to how music is so subjective. As a song, this is, it's good for me, but it's not my favorite.
It's interesting because I'd say the same. But I thought the quote was really interesting just because the sheer amount of praise that it gave the track. But I think I'd agree with you. I think there are better tracks on the album. Not that it's a bad one by any stretch.
Right, but a bad it's one so subjective, isn't it? It is so subjective, yeah. Music. One person's, you know, heavy metal is another person's Frank Sinatra, you know, and it's just sort of everything is so, it's the way that it hits you. And I can certainly see the musicality on it and the technicality on it, her ability to sing the way that they're saying in that quote. But yeah, like I said, it's not the thing that, you know, I would take to a desert island, right?
Yeah. So we'll move on to Don't Let Me Lose This Dream. So it's our first song on the album with a songwriting credit for Aretha, along with her husband, Ted White. We've talked a little already about Aretha's ability to make a song her own. Respect is a really good example of that. How do you rate Aretha Franklin as a songwriter in her own right? Because this is the first opportunity we've had to really kind of get into that.
Oh, okay. Well, this is going to be controversial, but I think her songwriting is uneven.
Okay.
I think that this is another one. Don't Let Me Lose This Dream is not an amazing song for me. They have this kind of bossa nova beat in the background, and it's just a bit sort of jazzy, and it feels like it's kind of disengaged, and it's co-written with her husband, Ted White. I just sort of wonder, I get this sort of like feeling like there's this guy kind of standing over her shoulder being like, you know, we got to do it like this. We're going to do it like this. You know, I told you last time we're going to do it like this, you know, or this is how you should do it. This is the best way you are. I don't know what that feeling is, but it just is kind of, it's like there's a disengagement or a removed sense. It gets better as the song goes on, but I never loved it that much. But then you go into the next track, Baby, 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 and she co-wrote that with her sister, Carolyn Franklin. And that I love. I just love that song. It just sounds so personal and so vulnerable and so intimate. I mean, one of the things we haven't talked about the album yet is that there are so many songs in 6/8, which is a tempo. It's a rhythm way of, you know, dividing up the eighth notes. So it's a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. So there's a natural sway to a 6/8 song, a song that is in 6/8. And that really seems to serve her voice, seems to serve the emotion. You start listening to those, you know, this album, now you realize that more than half of the album is in 6/8, which is amazing because most pop songs are in 4/4 and that's the end of it, you know? So Don't Let Me Lose This Dream is not in 6/8. Baby, Baby, Baby is. And I Never Loved a Man isn't also in 6/8, you know? So there's something for me when she's in 6/8, she's singing a ballad and she's really down in her lower register and she's allowing her vulnerability to come out. And then she has these high vocal stabs and goes up to this huge soaring gospel range that she has. That just really hits the mark in terms of what I was talking before, but the duality of vulnerability and power and female empowerment and self-confidence versus doubt. And, you know, I need this man. I love this man. Don't do me wrong, daddy. But then also I'm in charge here. You need me more than I need you, kind of a thing, which I just don't get on Don't Let Me Lose This Dream when she's writing with Ted White, her husband, who's her manager. Why is her manager husband writing with her? I don't really understand. But it all seems a bit weird to me. So there you have it. That's my two cents.
It's really interesting because I've got a quote from American Standard Time, and they actually call the song an anomaly on the album, which would kind of really tie in with what you're saying. Talks about the bossa rhythm with clave-like drums. The fact that it made it onto such a soulful album shows how much trust Jerry Wexler had in Ted and Aretha's search for a new image. Do you get that kind of feel that possibly that was them saying, you know, throw this at the wall and see if this works?
Yeah, well, I actually think probably Jerry Wexler had a bit of a politician in him, just being like, or a diplomat is probably a better word, where he was sort of saying, Ted probably wrote this song, and Aretha says, you've got to put this song on there. We need this song on there. We have the songwriting credits on here. I wrote this song, blah, blah, blah. Jerry goes, well, listen, I've struggled so hard to get this damn album made. Whatever I have to do to, you know, to mollify the manager who nearly caused the entire thing to fall apart. Fine. I'll put your bloody song on there. Okay. Don't Let Me Lose This Dream is going on there. Great. You guys got it on there, but it's an anomaly. As it says, it just doesn't seem to fit. And it's not, I mean, it's an okay song. I mean, there's a lot worse songs out there, but it's not really particularly like well-written in terms of Tin Pan Alley songs or songs that are just like narrative and beautiful. It's okay. I mean, I know that sounds like sacrilege to say about Aretha Franklin and her incredible album, but this is just okay. The rest of the album is just so good that maybe that's why it just seems okay.
Yeah. So we'll move on to one of your favorite tracks on the album, Baby, Baby, Baby.
Right.
As you touched on, written by Aretha, this time with her younger sister, Carolyn, who we've talked about earlier. You know, she helped arrange Respect. She is part of the backing vocals on this album. She actually had a bit of a music career herself before she stepped aside to write with and for Aretha. How much do we know about Carolyn? And have you heard any of her music?
No.
That she had it, right?
No, I haven't. No, I'm sorry to say I haven't.
No, no, neither have I. I guess it's something that I'm definitely going to have to seek out. It's something that I'm very interested to hear kind of what her style was and what sort of music she was doing. How much do we know about her beyond that? Is there much to say there?
I don't really know, actually. I mean, I don't know her music. I don't know what's happened to her historically. I don't know if she's still alive. I don't know if she tours. I just don't know anything about her. But I know that on this song that, you know, well, she's singing backup with Aretha. So like you said, they're the ones doing the Soccer to Me bit on Respect, you know. So I get this sense on Baby, 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 like it just, and this is before I knew any of this. You remember how I was saying right back at the beginning, I've had this relationship with this album. And then as I get to know more about the background of it and the musicality of it, and I become sort of more experienced in my own career, I have a different relationship with it. But it only sort of intensifies and validates the feelings that I had initially. So my initial impression was it was this song, Baby, 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 that I was listening to when I was standing on that driveway with the cracked weeds in the driveway and the studio falling apart in New Orleans. And I'm thinking, I just need to get grounded here. And I listen to this song and it brings me back to this very essential part of myself, this very deep inner honesty, which I think this song does. And then it wasn't until later that I found out that she co-wrote it with her sister and that the whole story of the album and it just all sort of comes together. But that just adds to the sense of very honest, emotional directness that she has on this song, which I just absolutely love. And again, it's another one in 6/8.
And I love the fact that you enjoy this one so much, it's one of your favorites, because I actually think it's one of the more underrated songs on the album. I think it has a real gospel feel to it. And vocally, Aretha plays it absolutely perfectly. As Aretha's career went on, Aretha and Carolyn would write some of her hits together, including Angel, Pullin', Ain't No Way. They'd go on to be hits on later albums. Do you think that this one, you know, do you think it's underrated compared to those? How do you think it stands against those bigger Aretha tracks?
Well, I would say it's hugely underrated. I think it's one of those things where you come up with your own personal relationship with it and you think it's a really important track. And then it sort of surprises me to hear that people are sort of like, yeah, whatevs. You know, I mean, it's an incredible track and it's so honest. And if you can even have a modicum of the ability of the players and the way it all aligned and the emotional directness of that, then you'd be doing so well. It's ridiculous, you know? So whatever to the naysayers.
So we'll move on to Dr. Feelgood, Love is Serious Business. So in the book, I Never Loved a Man the Way That I Love You, Aretha Franklin, Respect and the Making of a Soul Music Masterpiece, Matt Dobkin says of this track, Dr. Feelgood, the song recorded on the third and final day of the I Never Loved a Man sessions exemplifies the knotty but rich confluence of spirituality, sex and the blues that characterised Aretha's upbringing and her subsequent musical identity. We've talked a bit about the title track being this moment where we see who Aretha is. Do you think Dr. Feelgood is another moment where she defines who she is as an artist and indeed as a woman as well?
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting because this was also co-written with her husband, Ted White. And I like it so much better than Don't Let Me Lose This Dream. It's a really good song and it's a very sexy song. Like if I put the album into sort of like A, B and C in terms of their importance to me personally, this would be sort of medium importance to me personally. But I think it's such an important song on the album because it was all that female empowerment. It's claiming sexuality. It seems very timely. 1967, like this is sort of the, you know, the sexual revolution and the civil rights and women coming into their own and all these things sort of coming to the confluence in terms of the zeitgeist. And then this is a very, very timely song, very appropriate for stepping over this threshold and sort of claiming sexuality. So I think, yeah, it's very, very important.
So obviously, while the studio album version is fantastic, it's in fact live performances of the song that perhaps remembered the most by a lot of people, particularly one rendition of it at the Fillmore West in 1971.
Oh, right. Yeah.
So have you seen that performance? And for those who haven't, why do you think it's so fondly remembered?
Well, I haven't seen that particular performance, but I know the Fillmore is one of those venues in San Francisco that just really was so important in terms of cutting edge, massive music direction. I think Aretha would give a powerhouse version of this. And of course, 1971, this is when all feminism is starting to come to fruition. And it would just be sort of like a, you know, a real calling card, I think, to this new movement pushing through.
So the New Yorker said the following about this particular performance at the Fillmore. He said, "The recording verges on epic thanks to what follows, which is scandalous and sublimely virtuosic. Describing how me and my man get to lovin', Franklin groans, whoops, sings too fast, and strains so high that her voice cracks. It's an astonishing, calculated loss of control. Such a surprise from a do-right preacher's daughter. In another show of intimacy, she suggests that they try her good doctor too. After one visit to Dr. Feelgood, you'll understand why Feelgood is his name. The crowd, singing along with the chorus, becomes a congregation." So it sounds like, I'm going to have to check this performance out as well, it sounds like it really was a watershed performance in her career. And obviously, an important song, therefore, for the album and her career.
Yeah. Well, I'll definitely have to check that out.
So we'll move on to Good Times. Good Times is one of two songs on the album, written and made famous by Sam Cooke. So many have speculated that its inclusion, as well as final track of Change Is Gonna Come, something or a tribute to Cooke, who passed away 3 years earlier. How influential was Sam Cooke on Aretha's career? And indeed your own, because I know you'd said that you love Sam Cooke as well.
You know, he was such an amazing, amazing singer. He just was another singer where you'd hear one note being sung and you knew it was him. And I think this is a quality, again, that I just love so much in singers, where even if they've passed away long ago, you just feel like they're right there in your ear and their emotion is so timeless and is so immediate. Like Billie Holiday is another one. You just listen to the voice and it's just right there. Like it speaks to you like it's the most present thing. So Sam Cooke, I think, is one of the best voices in the entire history of the world. And he was also an incredible guy. Like he really started to get, and he was a really good businessman. And he was coming up in a time that it was obviously the civil rights and was quite troubled. And he really had to sort of fight for respect, but he was operating in the white pop culture as well. And, you know, he just really, he sort of navigated these choppy waters with such grace, both musically and business-wise, that it's sort of inspiring to see. And then I think he was also a very good songwriter. And that's what a lot of people don't know about him, is that he was such a, with that kind of talent and that kind of voice, you wouldn't think, oh my God, he's also going to be a songwriter, especially at that time, because it wasn't really the age of the singer-songwriter. It was just kind of breaking through, but, you know, in African American culture, not quite as much. And so he wrote some incredible songs. Good Times is one of them. And A Change Is Going to Come as the final track on Aretha's album. And, you know, her version of Good Times, I really like her version of Good Times. But for both of these, again, controversially, I feel like he does a better version, especially A Change Is Going to Come on the last track on her album here. It's so, so heartfelt. It's so personal and so immediate and pleading and visceral that I just don't think that anybody could ever do a cover of that song and make it as good as his version. So in some ways, I think that she's pretty ballsy to do this. She's just like, you know, I'm going to do this as a kind of nod to this amazing man who was murdered in very strange circumstances. Like I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but his demise has always made me feel quite questioning about all this. It's a new Netflix. It's not Netflix or Sky. I can't remember, but there's some documentary out right now that is sort of talking about his murder, and it just seems pretty questionable. And that there would be a lot of people at the time in white society that were really threatened by his political and business sense, and it would have been thought that his presence was very inconvenient. So there's a lot of questions around that, and I would assume that Aretha is probably both moved by him musically and was also trying to do a tribute to him in terms of his role in Black society at this very important time in American politics.
Absolutely. We'll talk a lot more about Change Is Gonna Come in a few minutes when we get to it. We'll move on to our next track, Do Right Woman, Do Right Man, another one of your favorites.
Oh my God. I absolutely love this song so much. Love it. Another one in 6/8, and I can hear it now. It's playing through my head right now because it's so ingrained in my brain and the, you know, the sound of her voice when she says, "Take me to heart." She's just so vulnerable and sensual and powerful, but exposed. I love that. I just love how she is sort of pleading, but also powerful. It just really moves me.
Yeah. And I mean, obviously, it's one of your favorites on the album. It was released as a single. How, in what way do you think it holds its own against the title track and Respect? What is it about it that makes it stand out for you?
Well, I think it's an incredibly well-written song. It's Dan Penn and Chip's moment, and they, you know, it was a very well-written song. And I think that the style of the musicians from Muscle Shoals and the Fame Studio would just really did it justice. They gave it this very sort of bluesy, earthy soul quality. And then her voice sounds like it's just at its best. It's in these, I mean, I love Aretha ballads. They just really do it for me, especially the ones in 6/8 with this really earthy Muscle Shoals sound. So I think that this is, you know, an absolute standout track in that regard. Just like I Never Loved a Man, it's just one of those tracks that is this album for me.
It's another great example of her sisters Carolyn and Irma, who we haven't really talked about yet, but Carolyn and Irma are present on the album for Back and Vocals. How much does this album, particularly this song, benefit from her sisters appearing on it? Not so much from the songwriting perspective, but from the back and vocals perspective. How important is that to the sound of the album?
Well, it's really important. And I think that comes from Aretha's gospel roots, because it's like this sort of call and response and this, you know, really communal delivery. And I think she benefits from having that sort of female power backing her up. And then she gets to soar on top. And she's clearly so familiar with the way that sort of works, that it just feels like it's a family affair. And then it literally is a family affair, because it's her two sisters. They're so, she must feel very safe with them backing her up like that, both musically and personally.
And I love that you've brought the family aspect into it, because there's always something for me about kind of families harmonizing. There's something about kind of, if it's like sisters or siblings, or there's something about families harmonizing that I love, which obviously is something that this album benefits from hugely. And that's not necessarily something you would know on first listen, just listening to the album. But there is something about that. And obviously there's so many examples of that over the years, but when siblings or families get together, there's something about their voices harmonizing that I particularly love. And I think that's a huge strength on this album.
Yeah, I mean, there would be both a sort of scientific reason for that and an emotional reason, because of course, emotionally, you would have grown up historically with these people. You're going to be singing all the time. You're going to be able to finish each other's sentences. You know exactly what they're going to do. You know exactly what works for, and then they know and expect exactly what you're going to do. But then from a scientific point, the voice, people forget this, but it is actually an instrument. So it's made up of your vocal cords, and genetically each person's vocal cords are, you know, created a certain way. And I always thought that, you know, with siblings, that there was going to be similarities in the way that it's almost as if you would have a violin made by the same violin maker, like a Stradivarius is going to sound like a Stradivarius. Now they're two different instruments, but they are made by the same maker. So they have this very similar quality, or they blend very well together. The frequencies that come out of them are really complementary to each other. So I think there's a lot of reasons why that might work.
Absolutely, yeah. So we'll move on to Save Me. So written by Aretha Carolyn and King Curtis. I feel like Save Me has much more of almost a rocky vibe to it compared to the rest of the album. Would you agree with that? Do you think that she kind of suits that rocky vibe, or do you think it's maybe like other songs on the album where it's kind of, she's got this new identity, she's wanting to see kind of what works?
Yeah, I it's not a standout track for me. It's good. I like the rocky better than, for instance, I like the Don't Let Me Lose This Dream with the bossa nova kind of jazzy thing. I think that the rocky sort of brings it up. Otherwise, it would be all ballads, you know, except for Respect and Dr. Feel. Well, even Dr. Feelgood is a ballad, but, you know, it's good to have some kind of rocky bits on there. But that's only for balance. And it's not like a track that I would go to as a single that I would think, oh, my goodness, I've got to hear Save Me. You know, just that doesn't really happen personally for me. But again, I see the merit of it, and I know why they did it, and I think it works.
So we'll move on to A Change Is Gonna Come, which is our final track on the album. It's perhaps Sam Cooke's most well-known song, and in my opinion, and I'm sure yours as well, one of the most important songs in music history.
Oh my God, yes.
The story behind it was that Cooke was apparently turned away from a whites-only motel, and that event inspired him to write the song. So in the same way that Respect marked a movement in women's rights, A Change Is Gonna Come did the same for civil rights in the US. Was that part of what inspired Aretha to choose to cover it? I know we've talked again about some of the respect and admiration that she had for Sam Cooke.
Well, it must have, because how could you possibly be black in America in 1967 and not have felt this pervasive racism? I mean, it was systematic. And I think she must have been really, truly troubled by it. I mean, I don't see how you possibly couldn't be. And so I think that, you know, it was her tribute to Sam Cooke. And like I said, what a fantastic voice he was, but also what a fantastic communicator he was, because the world needed to hear A Change Is Gonna Come at the time. People needed something that was the narrative of what they were going through. It's just one of those songs that manages to break your heart and give you hope at the same time. It's just incredible.
So American Standard Time point out while discussing this song that it's easy to forget that for people of colour like Sam Cooke and Aretha Franklin, that there was no stardom as we imagine it in the 60s. And that's a really good point, that what they were doing by becoming huge stars and releasing songs like this is that they were breaking down walls and boundaries that almost it's hard to comprehend 50 years on that they had to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, I think they were totally reinventing, you know, everything was in flux. The world was in flux then too, but they also, they just, you know, they're, you know, nothing but subjugation and being taken advantage of. And I mean, there's just long histories of people like Elvis Presley taking, you know, Big Mama Thornton's song and making it a huge success. And she'd been doing that for ages. I mean, there was just lots of people taking Black success and then making it into this like mainstream white radio culture. And the, Sam Cooke and Aretha Franklin were really the new generation, people that were becoming stars in their own right. And that wasn't done yet. And that it's amazing, you know.
As we've said, it's a really important song. And to be honest, you could probably do a whole podcast on the song and its wider implications. But if we focus on Aretha's interpretation of it, there's some really nice little nods to Sam, as well as that kind of trademark tinkering around the lyrics. So there's that part start where it's basically kind of saying, you know, a friend once told me this. And, you know, so I think that's lovely. But perhaps the most poignant change she made to any song on the whole album is here. So Sputnik Music said that the last words you hear, a change has come. Not a change is gonna come, a change has come. And post-civil rights, I think that says it all about the importance of both Aretha and Sam Cooke, that when he wrote that song, it was a change is gonna come. By the time Aretha was recording it, maybe it was a message of hope that a change has come and that things are gonna change. And I think that's a lovely touch and a really strong message to end the album on.
A very strong message, because he did it in 1964 and she was doing this in 1967. And those were three really important years in terms of civil rights. You know, I think it's obviously somewhat hopeful, though, to say that change has come, because there was many, many years following where there was still a lot of systematic racism. And there is still as well. I mean, even though we had Barack Obama, there's a lot of problems in America, and it's sort of like coming around again. But we don't need to get into that now. But I think that it was a way of her, you know, saying to her friends that, you know, you could be proud of where America is going at that point.
So I know you've said, obviously, that Sam Cooke's version is the definitive version. I'm sure even Aretha wouldn't argue with that. How does The Change Is Going to Come end the album for you? Is it a strong finish?
I think it's a strong finish because this is an important album for not just Black Americans, not just women, but, you know, all people over the world, because this is somebody who's just sort of stepped into their own and claimed their power and is doing it soulfully and with, you know, dignity and power and grace. And so I think, you know, Sam did all of those things. And so she's, you know, this is really important to say a change is going to come, because it's going to come for Aretha as well. This is her breakthrough album, and it's a breakthrough for American soul music, and it's a, you know, breakthrough for the way that people hear women singing. So I think all of that is really, it's a very appropriate choice. But I do think that it is Sam's song. I would go to his version if I were listening to this song. And that of all the songs on the album, you know, I love Respect, although it's been played so many times on radio that probably I wouldn't listen to it that much, but it would be Drown in My Tears, I Never Loved a Man, and Baby, 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 and Do Right Woman. Those are the four that I just could not live without. And then I couldn't live without A Change Is Going to Come by Sam Cooke, but his version.
So I Never Loved a Man, The Way I Love You is the album where Aretha Franklin found her voice and made the world stand up and take notice. So Rolling Stone sum up the importance of the album. They say they could have called the LP Respect or Soul Serenade, which sounds more classy, but I Never Loved a Man, The Way I Love You is more striking. It puts the emphasis not just on the great songs or the amazing music, but on the person speaking them, her world, her story, and whatever journey she's on in life. It rings out like revealed truth happening in real time, a declaration of independence. With that in mind, how does this album stand the test of time for you?
Well, it's a classic. It's an absolute classic. And I like that quote because they're sort of pointing out the use of the pronoun, I never loved a man. And it is very personal. This song feels very deeply personal, like it's someone who is claiming their history, their vulnerability, their tragedy, and then is coming into their own in this incredible self-determination and empowerment of self that really is. It still jumps out. And I know I'm throwing around big words here, but just from a musical standpoint, also, like, her voice still sounds so fresh. It still sounds like, you know, you're in the room with her, and you kind of have these, there's a few artists in the world where you just sort of can't believe that talent could have existed. And her voice on this record, I mean, she wasn't like this her whole life. She had an incredible voice, but she couldn't really sing by the end of her life. And, you know, there were other things I think she did in the 80s that just didn't showcase her singing in the same way. But for me, this album showcases the perfect musicianship underneath her, the perfect emotional quality of what she's singing in the songs. And then her voice is at its peak. And I just think it's, you know, it's so current, even though it's a classic.
And finally, why is I Never Loved a Man the Way I Love You your classic album? And why should people check it out if they haven't already?
Well, for all of those reasons. Because, like I said, as a person who's at the peak of their talent, they're just about to step over this threshold into this exciting new world and define themselves. But it's that stepping over the threshold that is the moment of absolute excitement. It's like just dropping over a cliff. What's going to happen next? And you're going on this journey with this person, and you know, you can put on headphones and she's right there in your ear. She's like a close friend that is speaking right to you. So, you know, even the millions of people that have heard this album over the years, she could sing it to you and it would be only to you, and like it would feel like you were the first person that ever heard it. It's just got this very immediate quality to it.
Well, Nell, thank you so much for joining us. It's been lovely to chat about this album. What's happening for you at the moment?
Well, I just recorded an album myself of songs. I had taken a break to write a novel, and then I finished the novel and I was still writing about the characters, and I started writing a whole bunch of songs about these two characters. And then when it came time to go record it, I actually went back to this album, which I think is why it just immediately came into my mind when you asked me what we should talk about. Because when I was a little baby starting out, it was the album that I would always listen to in New Orleans when I was, you know, in that driveway, like I said. And then here in London recording this album, it was the thing that I used to inspire the sound. And I ended up producing the album myself and going in, recording it with my band that I was very familiar with. And we all love those Muscle Shoals studio band sound. And we directly referenced the Spooner Oldham sound and the Wurlitzer and the way it was recorded and the way the drums are recorded, and everything was sort of built to have that, that very vintage sound. And we recorded it to 2-inch tape, so it would have that really warm quality in the rhythm section, very bassy. And then I, you know, was able to sing in a way that I find really inspiring. So, you know, I've released an EP of the first 4 songs of those, and I'll release another EP next year and then following that. But, you know, you never know what's going to happen in life. But if you're creating something that has meaning to you, then that's all that any artist really wants. So I have to thank Aretha for this album, for being such an inspiration to me personally.
You're touring the UK as well, aren't you?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I guess I should mention that. Yeah, sorry. Oh, forget. Yeah, I'm going with the same players that I did in the studio, actually. We recorded in Ray Davies' Conch Studios up in Crouch End in London, and we're all going to go on the road together. So they're a lovely bunch of guys, and we'll be all in around the UK in June and July. So people can see all the tour dates up on NellBryden.com.
Huge thanks to Nell Bryden for coming on the show and chatting with me about her classic album, Aretha Franklin's I Never Loved a Man the Way That I Love You. And it's just lovely and an absolute privilege to be able to talk with people about the music that they love and how it informs their own music. And not just Aretha Franklin, but Otis Redding and Sam Cooke and all the people, a lot of the people that we've talked about today. Nell obviously has a very deep love for all those singers and the way that they produced music as well. And I think that has had an effect on the way that she produces music. And I think she touched on that at the end of our chat. Her latest EP, Soundtrack to Little Wing Part 1, is out now. And that and future EPs will form the soundtrack to her debut novel, which will be Little Wing. And I'm very excited to read it. I think it's just that's a really interesting process that she's gone through, and a huge journey for her, I'm sure. If you want to keep on top of all of that stuff involving Nell, all the Little Wing and the soundtrack to Little Wing, get yourself over to www.nellbryden.com. And of course, as she was touching on at the end there, a tour. She's touring next month across the UK, and all of the tour dates will be up there. I'm going to try and get myself to the Newcastle show. So as always, if you see me, please come and say hi. I would love to meet some people who listen to the podcast. That would be awesome. And there goes another episode of My Classic Album. Thank you very much for joining me. As I said at the top of the show, in a couple of weeks' time, Savannah Pope will be joining me to chat about the soundtrack to the Rocky Horror Picture Show. I'm very excited for you to hear this one. It was a lot of fun. So I'll see you in a couple of weeks' time over at the Frankenstein Place. But until then, I've been Mike Norris, and thank you so much for listening once again. Cheers.